So today, I continue. First, I continue my discussion about the effective action, because which is this object, which I call gamma of a field, and because we have not finished with it. And first, I will remember you prove the important formula for the form at one loop, because I gave you the form of this effective action and I showed what it gives, but I didn't prove the formula. And second, I will discuss a few properties, important properties, which in particular justifies the name of effective action. Why do we call this an effective action? Okay. And then I start to discuss the problem of renormalization. Why in the phi-4 theory, and why we need renormalization to build a sensible physical theory. Okay. So first, let me remind that we started from a classical theory, classical field theory, and the classical physics of a classical field theory is given, in fact, by the action, by its classical action. Action S of phi. Okay, so phi is a field, classical field. Phi of x is a classical field. And the classical action, for instance, is for the phi-4 theory, 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared plus g over factorial 4 phi-4. And I integrate over space-time. And here, for simplicity, I took here the action in Euclidean space-time. So here it is in Euclidean space-time. But that's mainly at that point for mathematical convenience. We have seen how we can recover physical quantities in Minkowski space, in the real physical theory with real time, from what we are able to compute in the theory at Euclidean time. Okay? And we have seen that from that. Yes? Oh, I am sorry. Not very well awake. This is, of course, a phi squared. Okay. And we have seen that we defined a quantum object in the quantum theory. We defined the quantum theory in principle is defined from a path integral, Z, which is integral over all the P of phi exponential of minus 1 over h bar SE of phi. So from this path integral, we can compute all the quantum, you know, the matrix element of operator of the quantum theory. So this is an integral over classical fields, but out of that, we get the quantum object. And we have seen that, in fact, the good object to consider is the generating function, which was written like that. This is a generating function for all the vacuum expectation value of operator of the quantum theory by adding to this classical action a term which depends on a source term. So G is a G, which is, of course, G of X, is what is called a classical source term. Okay. And we have seen that it is more convenient, in fact, to consider W of G, which is h bar times the logarithm of this generating function for correlation functions. And then that what is more important is that we can compute what is the Legendre transform of W of G, which is the classical action, which is the effective action, and which is defined as gamma of phi equal G dot phi minus W of phi with phi defined as a functional derivative of W of chi with respect to G of X. And so this effective action gamma of phi is now is a functional of phi, which is called the background field. Okay. And yes, sorry. Pardon?
What is the significance of the background field?
Here, at the moment, take it as a mathematical definition. I already told you that, in fact, I explained on Friday that this corresponds to, well, from the very definition of this, of the functional WG, that this corresponds to the expectation value of the field operator in the quantum theory, but in the presence of the background field G. So this is the vacuum expectation value of the field operator capital phi in a quantum theory where the action is given by the classical action minus G phi. So it is the vacuum expectation value of a quantum operator. So the matrix element of a quantum operator in the vacuum of the three, but in the vacuum which depends on G. But I will explain to you a bit later another. I will give you a slightly different. Okay, so. Oh, no, sorry. Okay, so, and yes?
In the definition of gamma phi, is that in the right hand side, is that the W phi is.
I'm sorry, could you speak a bit louder?
In the definition of gamma phi,
yes?
In the square bracket of the W phi, is actually J. The
what?
W phi is J.
What is the square bracket?
In definition of the gamma phi.
J dot phi minus W.
This?
Correct.
Not this?
No.
He's saying
you're using the wrong argument for W.
Sorry?
Minus W.
Minus W, J.
He's saying it.
Yeah? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really not awake today. This is, of course, W of J. Yes. Thank you very much. Yes?
Do you mind reminding us what is the difference between the classical and things you said, this partition function is quantum, but
yes,
it derived from the classical action.
Yeah, but it's derived from the classical action by performing this functional integral, namely this path integral over all the possible configuration of a classical field. So by doing that, we are summing over all the possible histories for the field and ponderating with a phase which is exponential of, well, in the real time exponential, I times the action. So we are doing for a field exactly what you did in the quantum mechanical course for the particle. So in some sense, the path integral builds the wave function for the field, so Schrödinger wave function for the field, out of all the possible classical configuration for the field. So in that sense, the path integral or the functional integrals is really a quantum object.
When you are saying the, all the possible classical configuration,
yes.
The classical configuration and those around classical.
Yeah, no. That's, when I say classical, I mean configuration which can be thought of as characterized by a well-defined classical value. So, for instance, a classical particle is characterized by its position and its speed. But a quantum particle is not, you know, you have to know the wave function of the particle, the whole wave function over the whole space, to know in which state your quantum particle is. So you cannot think of a quantum particle as having a definite position and a definite momenta. So in that sense, but you can think of a wave function of a particle as being a quantum superposition of states where the particle has a definite position. You see, in a, you can view the wave function of a particle, psi of q. Here I'm considering a class, a particle, a quantum particle. You can consider its wave function, just as, so consider the state, the ket, which is psi. So the, consider rather the state of a particle in of a quantum particle given by wave function psi as simply a linear combination, a quantum superposition of states where the position is, the particle is in a position eigenstate. So in such a state, the particle has a well-defined classical position. You see? Times the value of the wave function at the position psi, which is a complex number. This is a complex probability amplitudes. And you sum, in fact it's an integral, but you sum over all possible position q. You see? So you can always think about the wave function, the quantum state of a particle, as a linear superposition, but a quantum superposition of states where the particle has a well-defined classical position. And the probability amplitude associated to the state where the particle has a well-defined classical position is just the value of the wave function at point q. You see? So here we are doing exactly the same thing, but for an object which is much, much more complicated, which is a field. I hope it's clear. Okay, so let me go back to this point. So I gave you a formula. I told you, but I claim that the effective action for a given background field configuration, when computed for any quantum theory, is given at first order by the classical action and the first quantum correction, because if you are in quantum theory, you have quantum correction to the classical action, hence they are proportional to h bar. This is given simply by h bar 1/2 of the trace of a big operator, which is the logarithm of the second derivative of the classical action at two different points. And then you have correction, subdominant quantum correction of order h bar squared. And this operator is called the Hessian, of the theory. Delta of classical action of phi over delta phi of x, delta phi of y, which I can denote the second derivative of the action taken at point x and y. This is defines an operator which is called the Hessian of the functional S of the classical action. S. Okay? And so what remains to be done now is to prove this formula. And since you already studied how you do path integrals and Gaussian integrals, this is very reminiscent of a formula of Gaussian integration. We'll see that, in fact, this is just a consequence of a simple calculation of Gaussian integration. So let us do that. So now what I'm going to do is to do the proof of this beautiful formula. And for that, we just have to go back to the definition. First, we start from the original functional Z of G, which is, as we have seen, a functional integral over field configuration of exponential of minus 1 over h bar okay?
Yes, okay.
And since h bar is small, we assume we are doing a semi-classical perturbative expansion. So we assume that h bar is small. So the idea is look for the extremum, the minimal point for this action. So h bar is small, this suggests that look for the so-called saddle point of S of phi minus G of phi. Okay? So this means that we are looking for the point where this functional S of phi minus G times phi is minimum. Because that's the point. If this is minimum, the exponential of minus this will be maximum, so this is the point which dominates in the functional integral. So, of course, this saddle point, let us call it phi classical, phi classical is a function which whose value is simply given by phi classical of x is given by the saddle point equation, delta S of phi divided by phi of x minus g of x equals 0. You see? Yes?
Are we calling this saddle point phi classical because that is the true classical field condition?
No, yeah. Yeah. I call this classical because, yes, because if h bar equals 0, this is the classical solution. Yes. So, in fact, you are right. I call it classical because if h bar was to zero, there would be no correction. Okay? And this would be the classical solution, but of course, when g is different from zero, remember. So this would be the classical solution where the field is subjected to an external source term, g of x. Otherwise, it would be this equation. Okay. So it is a solution. Phi of c of x is a solution of this equation. You see? So that's something that we can rewrite simply like the derivative of the action at a point x taken at the value phi c is equal to g of x. You see, that's just a shortened notation for functional derivative of the action with respect to the value of the field phi at point x taken at the value of the field configuration, which is phi classical. Okay? And of course, this phi c depends on g. So it depends on x, but it depends implicitly on phi. So in fact, phi c depends on g. So if you change the value of the source terms, you change the configuration, the classical configuration, because the classical equation has a term which is proportional to g. Okay? So, now, of course, the idea is that since h bar is small, the phi in the functional integral, can be expanded around the classical configuration. So we can say, make a change of variables. We write phi equal phi c plus something which turns out to be of order h bar minus one half times some phi tilde, where this is the classical configuration and this measures, you know, simply the quantum fluctuations inside the functional integral. So exactly like what we draw here for in a classical particle where we have in the path integral, we have a classical configuration, Q classical and as a function of time, and we have a small quantum fluctuation here.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Why is that h bar to the one
half? You'll see. That's because at the moment, it's just a definition. I said phi in the functional integral here is equal to phi c plus something which measures the quantum fluctuation, and I normalize it by h bar, one half. But you'll see. And then, of course, I can make the change of variable. So I can write the functional integral z of g as integral d phi tilde, okay, exponential minus 1 over h bar. And then I expand s of phi minus g phi around phi classical. Okay. And of course, when I expand, I found that S of phi is equal to S of phi classical plus h bar one half S prime of phi classical at point x dot phi tilde. See what it means? It means simply that And then I have a second order term, which is 1/2 of h bar 1. The second derivative of the action at phi close equal. So this is xy, phi tilde of y. And of course, I integrate here over x. And here I have to integrate over x and y. And then I have higher order term, which are of order h bar to the power 3/2. You see what it means. I'm just doing, this is just a Taylor expansion in phi. Then I have g dot phi. So I have to add this minus g times phi classical plus a term which is of order h bar 1/2 integral over x of g of x times phi tilde of x. And that's it.
Is that a minus h bar to the 1/2?
Yes, minus and minus. I'm sorry. Okay. Of course. Okay. And you see that from this equation, from the saddle point equation, these two terms cancel, of course. That's why you expand around this classical equation, this classical equation. You see, we expand around this particular value of the field, phi classical, because in that case, the linear term disappears. So we end up just with a term of order phi tilde squared. So you see that now the functional integral becomes exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi classical minus g times phi classical. And then I have a term which is minus 1/2. These terms, namely integral, double integral over x and y of the second derivative of the action at phi classical with respect at the point x and y times phi tilde of x, phi tilde of y. And then we have the other terms that we forgot here. And so you see that in this big, if we neglect those terms, this is a term which doesn't depend on phi tilde, the quantum fluctuation. And this is just a Gaussian term. You see? Yes?
Why is it that our path integral is now over the phi tilde?
Because I just make a change of variables. This doesn't depend. You see, this doesn't depend. So for a given g, this is just a field configuration. It doesn't fluctuate. So this is make just a change of variable. Convenient change of variables. See? Yes?
Shouldn't there be an extra root of h bar floating around somewhere? Because when we make that change of variables, there's also a change in the...
Well, there is an h bar, but it's in the measure.
Yeah,
but when you the functional integral is always used to compute expectation value of operator. So when you compute expectation value, you have a functional integral with the phi, and you have a functional integral without the phi. So the terms in the measure always cancel. So such a term, this is not exactly the same measure, but it's not important
okay.
At that stage, you see? Okay, so now you see that here you have an exponential of minus something, which is over the 1. So you see immediately why the quantum fluctuation phi tilde are over the 1, you see? If h bar is small, this term changes because it is over the 1 over h bar, but this term doesn't change. You see? So the phi tilde, the configuration phi tilde of x, are always over the 1 in the functional integral. That do not depend on h bar in this integral. And now, since this is a Gaussian integral, well, we can use the well-known results of a functional integral, is that if we have an integral over a vector x of exponential of minus 1 half x times some quadratic form, we know that this is simply equal to determinant of a over 2 pi to the power minus 1 half. This is a general formula. So here, what we get is simply for g of g. G of g is equal to, so this is, this g of, is equal to exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi c minus g dot phi c. This is a classical term. And then we get a quantum term, which is simply the determinant of this operator. Determinant of this operator phi c to the power minus 1 half. Again, I don't write the factor 2 pi because it goes in the measure. And the remaining terms here turns out to be just term of order h bar. So we can forget about them. So we have a compact formula at leading or at first order in h bar for z of g. You see, a very compact formula, which looks very much like the result we want to have. But we are not always, we are not completely done. See? Because now, of course, from that, it's easy to see that W of G, which is h bar times the logarithm of the expression, is, so the logarithm of an exponential, it is this. So this is G times phi c minus s of phi c. This is the first term. This is a classical term. And then we have a minus a term, which is now of order. So we have to take the logarithm of a determinant to the power minus 1 half. So the logarithm of a determinant is the trace of the logarithm. We use the fact that the logarithm of a determinant of an operator can always be written as the trace of the logarithm of this. And so we get minus h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of this operator, which is the second derivative of the action at phi c. You see? Yes?
What happened to the half integral part? Why does the integral over d phi tilde, why is that no longer here?
Because I performed. I performed here the path integral. Going from there to there, I compute the integral over phi tilde of the exponential of minus 1 half, second derivative, which is an operator, times phi tilde times phi tilde. So going from there to there, I can perform explicitly the path integral. So I have meant the functional integral. It's something very, very complicated, very big. It's a very big functional integral. But I can perform it because it is Gaussian. And we know how to perform Gaussian integral. We have this general formula. Okay? So we have an explicit formula for the functional W of G, which reminds you, gives you the connected diagram. So now we have to take the Legendre transform. Of this object. But now we have an explicit form for the Legendre transform. So we have to define what is the background field. Remember, the background field 5x is defined as the functional derivative of W with respect to the source term at a point x. Okay? And so now, remember, everywhere in this formula, phi c depends explicitly on g. And up to now, we worked at when g was fixed. This formula is valid when g is fixed. You see? So now we have to remember that W of G depends on G explicitly, and it depends on phi C here, here, and here, but phi C depends on G through the saddle point equation here. And so, when we have to do the calculation. So when we do the calculation, when you take the functional derivative of W of G with respect to the source term G of G, first we get a trivial term, which is of course phi C of G, and then we get a bunch of terms which comes from the explicit dependence on G of phi C. You see? So we get terms here from the fact that phi C depends on G. Okay? And since phi C depends on G, it means that if I change G into G plus delta G, phi c change into phi c plus delta g times the derivative of phi c with respect to g. That's a shorthand notation. Write that. You see? And so now we can compute easily these terms because we have two terms. You have terms which are proportional to d phi c with respect to g, which is something which is given, will be given by this indicated formula, and times the functional derivative, the derivative of this term with respect to phi c. And we get g minus delta s over delta phi. And then we get a term which is like that, which is of order h bar. And remember the saddle point equation. The saddle point equation, which tells you how phi c depends on g, does the job to tell you that this term is zero. So we can forget about the terms which come from the fact that phi c depends on g, in fact, cancel. So in fact, the result of this calculation is that the background field is equal to phi c of g, taken at point x, of course, plus terms of order h bar, the dangerous classical terms which could have been there cancelled. So in fact, classically, this means that classically, the background field is equal to the classical field But there are correction of order h bar. Okay? And the beauty of the calculation is that we don't need them. So we are recovering what you said, the fact that this is a classical object. Okay, and then we are almost done. Because now, remember, once we have the value of the background field, so the background field, phi is equal to the phi c. So once we have that, now we can compute. Now, we can compute the effective action. Why? Because remember, the definition of the effective action is simply g dot phi minus w of g. So this is g phi minus what we got there, g phi c plus S of phi c plus h bar over 2, the trace of the logarithm of this big operator evaluated at phi c. Okay? So here we have a classical term, if you want, but which contains terms of order h bar. And which contains an explicit term of order h bar. And now we are almost done. Because what we can do is simply remember that since phi is equal to phi c plus a correction of order h bar, we can invert the situation, and remember, now we have to, we want to express everything in terms of phi of the background field. So we can do just the opposite. We can write that phi c is equal to phi plus h bar times something that I don't know, but something, you see? And I expand, therefore, the classical action as a function of phi c. I can rewrite it as, of course, the classical action at the value of the background field, plus the correction. What is this correction? It is simply let us do the opposite. Let me write S of phi as S of phi c minus h bar. Well, these terms that I don't know, this delta phi dot the second derivative, the first derivative of Sx at point phi c. You see? I just expand S of phi. And I rewrite the action as a function of phi c, the classical field configuration, as a function of S of phi and of this small correction. So then these terms can be rewritten. So you see, these terms can be rewritten of G times phi minus phi c. But what is phi minus phi c? This is minus this is minus h bar times delta phi. And then let me rewrite S of phi c. S of phi c is S of phi, the value of the action at the classical field, plus h bar delta phi times the second derivative, the first derivative of the action at phi c. But since phi c is equal to phi plus something over order h bar, I can replace this by the value of the effective action. Oh, no, no, I don't need to do that. I can just write this as phi c. OK? So you see we have the action at phi plus a big term, which is proportional to delta, to delta little phi. So I can rewrite those two terms as h bar delta phi dot g minus the derivative of the action at phi c. I'm not sure you can see it because these terms can be written, which contains the action at the value of at the classical configuration of the field plus a term proportional to g, can be rewritten as the action at the background field configuration plus a correction of order h bar. And this correction of order h bar is equal to something, some function that I don't need to know, times the source term minus the derivative of the action at the value of the classical field configuration. And once again, the magic field equations tell me that this is equal to zero. So what remains from the calculation? What remains is this term, the classical action evaluated at the background field configuration, and this term. And this last term, of course, since it's a term of order h bar, it's almost what we want in the formula, the claim. The only difference is that here, the trace of the log of the second derivative of the action is evaluated at phi c, the classical field configuration, instead of being evaluated at phi, the background field. But the difference is of order h bar. And this term is already of order h bar. So if we expand it, the difference will be of order h bar squared. So we can finally write that h bar over 2 trace of log of the second derivative of the action at phi c is equal to h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of the second derivative of the action evaluated for a field configuration which is given by the background field plus O of h bar squared. And we are done. We have proved real true. So we are done. Quod erat demonstrandum. We have proven the formula of what's stated here. And we, you see that this formula is very, very general. We didn't need at all the form of the action. This is a general result. And we have applied on last Friday, we applied it to a specific theory, which was the 5-4 theory. But the result is very, very general. We just need to use Gaussian integration. You see? So it is valid as soon as you have fields phi or a mu or something, which are bosonic fields, namely spin 0, 1, 2, etc. So in fact, these results will be up to a problem related to gauge invariance. You can apply it directly when you do calculation in gauge theory, or even if you do calculation in quantum gravity. If you want to compute the effective action of quantum gravity, of general relativity, when you quantize it at one loop, and that has been done by Toft and Veltman a long time ago. In fact, it's an application of this formula with a lot of technical complication because of diffeomorphism invariance, but the basic idea is always the same. Yes?
During this calculation, didn't we implicitly assume there's only one classical point?
Yes, we singled out phi c.
Yes, but
yes.
I mean,
you.
Isn't it possible there could be more than one saddle point?
Yes, it's possible that there is more than one saddle point. And in that case, you have to take into account, in general, all of them. But well, in good BF theory, you have only one, you have generally one saddle point which has a minimum action, and the other one has higher action. So they are subdominant. But you are perfectly right. In fact, this formula, this semi-classical formula, is valid, in fact, even if you have more than one saddle point. And it leads to very interesting physical effects. But I won't discuss that here.
Excuse me?
Yes.
So here you have a background field.
Yes.
And a quantum field.
Yes.
And you use different notation. So can you summarize the differences or the connection between these two?
Okay, that's what I think I am going to answer your question just now, because once we have proven this formula, well, it took me more time than what I was expecting, but that's an important formula. So it's important that you understand how it works, because it's a very, very important formula in quantum field theory. Let me go to the two points. What are the important properties of this effective action? So we have seen Friday that, in fact, for property one, or property zero, if you want, is generate all Feynman diagrams, all irreducible diagrams and Feynman amplitudes. So it's a very important property one. So it's a very important at a technical level. It simplifies a lot the calculation. Now, here are more property two. Property two, which in fact is a general property of Legendre transform. The Legendre transform is in fact an evolution, is what is called an involution. It means that the Legendre transform of a function is a function you started from. You see? And it's a general properties of Legendre transforms. It has nothing to do with the specific Legendre transform we were interested in. And this means that W of G is itself the Legendre transform of the effective action gamma of phi. Gamma of phi was defined as a Legendre transform of W of G, but W of G is also the Legendre transform of gamma of phi, which means that W of G can be written as G dot phi minus gamma of phi. That's obvious from the fact that gamma of phi is G phi minus W of phi of G, but also, and that's less trivial than G of X is the functional derivative of the effective action when you vary the value of the background field 5x. You see? And this has a very important consequence. This means that let me write in a very schematic way gamma of phi as a function depending on the value of the background field phi. Of course, the space of configuration of the background field is an infinite dimensional space. But imagine that it just depends on one number. And gamma of phi, the effective action, is a function. Okay? This means that if you expect that phi 1 is equal to some value, then this is the source term you must apply to the quantum theory so that to get phi 1. And this means in particular that the equation g of x equals 0 means that the functional derivative of the effective action is 0. So what is interesting is to look at the minimum or the minima phi, 0, let us say, of the effective action. An interesting field configuration are the minima of the effective action because they correspond to properties of the quantum theory where the source term is not there. You see? Minima of the effective action equals no source term G. And now, remember, go back to the original definition. At the beginning of the definition, remember, phi was defined as delta W over delta G of X. And therefore, it corresponds to the vacuum expectation value of the filed operator 5x in the theory, the vacuum of the theory in the presence of the source term. Yes?
No.
No? OK. So This is a general definition. The background field corresponds in the original quantum theory to the expectation value of the field operator in the vacuum state of the theory where G is anything. Okay. So this is general properties. But setting G equals zero means that phi naught of X, the minimum of the effective action, is equal to the expectation value of the field operator phi of X in the vacuum state of the theory where G equals zero. So therefore, this corresponds here to, let us say, the vacuum state of the original theory. You see? So, phi zero minimum of the effective action, namely this, means if you find the minimum of the effective action, you know what the expectation value of the vacuum state of the origin of the field operator in the original theory. So you have access to a quantum observable out of a semi-classical calculation.
If,
yes?
When you say the original theory, do you mean non-classical
theory? No, I mean the original theory where I had no G.
Okay.
So the functional integral of the original theory where I had no G. So this is given, of course, by, remember, the functional integral of exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi, and then I normalized by s of phi. So you see? So if I have computed the effective action, instead of computing this big ratio of functional integral, or instead of trying to construct the vacuum state of an interacting field theory, which is a big complicated, I just have to look at the minimum here of the effective action. Yes?
Just to clarify, the capital phi is the small phi, right?
Pardon?
The capital phi is the small phi. It's the same thing, right?
Well, I use the capital phi because I use the capital phi to mean that it is a field operator. Operator acting on the Hilbert space of the theory. See? This is expectation value, so a matrix element of an operator in canonical quantization. And you can compute this, which is a number, it's a matrix element of an operator acting on the Hilbert space, which is the Fock space of the theory, using functional integral. But you can also compute it simply by looking at the minimum of a classical functional, of a functional, which is a functional of the background field. Okay. And this justifies, in fact, the two denominations. Phi is called the background field because it's the expectation value of the field operator in the quantum background of the theory. And the terminology itself of effective action or quantum action comes from the fact that, and I can perhaps just write this in, you remember, a classical action S of phi is a quantity such that its extremum phi c a classical solution of the equation of motion, and the effective or quantum action gamma phi has a similar properties, but its extremum, an extremum phi zero, is the expectation value in the vacuum of phi. So the extrema of a classical action gives you the value of the field in the classical vacuum, you see, while the extremum of the quantum or effective action gives you the expectation value of the field in the quantum quantum vacuum. So you see, so this justifies the name action. The effective action plays the same role in the quantum theory than the classical action plays in the classical theory. You look at, if you want, the equation of motion coming from the quantum action, the effective action, and what you get is something which is highly non-trivial, which is the expectation value of the field operator, which is a quantum object. It's a quantum operator. It's an observable in the quantum theory. It's given by a very big operator acting on a very big Hilbert space. And it gives you the expectation value of this observable in the vacuum of the theory. So it gives you properties of the vacuum of the theory, of the quantum vacuum of a quantum theory. But it gives it by an extremization procedure. Okay, and I realize I will have spent my whole lecture on the effective action, but I think that's worthwhile. So let me end up with one last property. Anyway, it doesn't make sense to go further. So, yes? Pardon?
If I look at an action like that, wouldn't the expectation of a single operator be zero?
Very good remark. Of course. In the 5-4 theory, this doesn't tell you anything. It's not very interesting for the pure 5-4 because, of course, in the 5-4 theory, is zero. But this is a very general result. So you may, so this is zero simply because, of course, the 5-4 theory has a symmetry, which is a Z2 symmetry, is a symmetry of change of the sign, and this symmetry is unbroken. The expectation value of phi in the vacuum of the theory is zero. But there are theories, indeed a very physical one, where you have a larger symmetry group. And those, or this symmetry, and where this symmetry may be what is called spontaneously broken. For instance, if you take a 5-4 theory with a potential like that, so with an action of the forms minus phi squared plus phi 4, so with a negative mass term, mass squared term, it has two extrema of the potential, as you, one of you. And one question is, does quantum effects changes the vacuum. So for instance, you may start from a theory which has two different classical vacuum, and you may be interested, does the quantum theory has still those two vacuum, or does it have a single symmetric vacuum? In order to do that, you have to compute the effect. The best, simplest way is to compute the effective action and look whether the effective action has this shape or whether it has this shape. Yes?
Why should the Z2 symmetry imply that this vacuum state expectation value equals zero?
No, there is a Z2 symmetry and it is unbroken because I add a plus phi squared plus phi 4.
Why does that imply that the expectation value equals zero?
If the symmetry is unbroken,
yes.
Then this is equal to zero.
But how does that imply that?
That's the definition of a broken or unbroken symmetry. You see. If you have, in the phi 4 theory, you have whatever the sign of the action, whatever both for an action with a plus phi squared term and for an action with a minus phi squared term, you have this symmetry. You can change phi into minus phi. In the action, it doesn't change anything. But now you may ask, in the quantum theory, is there one vacuum one vacuum state zero such that in this state this is equal to zero? Or are there two vacuum states, let us say, call them plus and minus, such that plus phi plus is positive, is equal to, let us say, some phi naught positive, and minus phi minus equal minus phi naught is negative. And in order to do that, you have to compute, one way to compute is to compute the quantum action and to see whether this quantum action has just a single minimum at phi equals zero, or whether it has two minima at minus phi naught and plus phi naught. And here, I just consider the simple case of a symmetry, which is a discrete symmetry where you change the sign. And you probably have heard already, or you will see in the introduction to quantum, to the standard model, that in fact, those issues of symmetry breaking or non-symmetry breaking are very important, but for a much more complicated and bigger symmetry group, which is the SU2. Of U1. In fact, it's a bit more complicated, but group of symmetry. In fact, there are two SU2 cross U1 symmetry in the standard model. Okay. And the issues of whether those symmetries are broken or unbroken is very important. To understand what are the properties of the vacuum state of the theory. And in particular, this is basically related to the Higgs mechanism. See? Okay, so so you have indeed cases where you may have several vacua, or you may have a vacua where the field operator gets a non-trivial expectation value. And to compute this non-trivial expectation value, you have to find the minima of the effective action. Okay, and let me just finish with the remark I wanted to. That's what I wanted to say. So one last remark, which is also a consequence of the fact that property 3, which is in fact a consequence of property 2, it's a consequence of the fact that the Poisson transform is an evolution. The two-point connected two-point function. So two points connected function of a quantum theory, which is called, in fact, the propagator, but the propagator, the general propagator in an interacting theory. So it is the propagator. So this function, this big function between x and y, you see, it's given in the 5-4 theory, but the propagator plus those diagrams, plus more complicated diagrams like that, plus et cetera. So it's sum over a lot of process, is given simply the term of the effective action or the quantum action as you consider the second derivative of the effective action with respect to the background field. You evaluate it at phi naught, the minimum of the effective action. You take the inverse of this matrix, and you evaluate it at point x and y. So in other words, this two-point connected function is the inverse of the Hessian of the effective action. See, we have seen that the effective action is related to the trace of the logarithm of the determinant of the classical action. But on the opposite, if you know the effective action, you compute its second derivative, it's an operator. You compute its inverse, and you get the full two-point connection function of the field theory. And it is just a generalization. Oops. It's a generalization of the well-known result for the free theory, which is that the propagator in a free theory, phi of x, phi of y, free theory. For the free theory, we know that the propagator is just the inverse of the Laplacian, of the minus Laplacian plus m square x naught, so between the point x and y. And this is so because for a free theory, gamma of phi is equal to S0 of phi plus something which is independent of phi because it's a Gaussian, so it's a constant. For the free theory, the effective action is equal to the classical action plus something which is independent of phi because it's a Gaussian. And therefore, the second derivative for free theory is the second derivative of the classical action beta to phi, and therefore it is the operator minus Laplacian for n squared. So the beauty of the formalism of the effective action is that this formula is very general. It's not restricted to the to the free theory. So of course, in an interacting theory, the second derivative of the effective action is depends on phi. So we have seen that, for instance, for the phi 4 theory, this operator delta 2 squared over delta phi is equal to minus Laplacian plus m squared plus g over 2 pi squared. So it depends on phi. But then there is a correction of order h bar, which is something more complicated, which depends on phi, which is given by those, by these non-trivial diagrams, like that. And, but it's a general formula. Okay. Okay, so I realized that I needed the whole lecture to discuss the effective action, but it's not at all a problem because it means that there were a lot of non-trivial things to understand. And well, but tomorrow we'll start to discuss the problem of pronormalization and how we compute effectively physical quantity in the phi 4 theory and why we need pronormalization and what we do to renormalize the theory. Thank you.